Hello, everybody. I'm Howie Hawkins. I was the Green Party candidate for president and the Socialist Party candidate in 2020. And this program, Green Socialist Notes, is about continuing to educate and organize around the eco-socialist program that Angela Walker and I ran on. So I'm in Chicago at the Socialism 2023 conference, and I hope to grab somebody here to be a guest, but everybody turned me down. I got, you know, four good people who said they can't do it today. There's a lot going on at the conference, but they'd like to do it in the future. So it hasn't been that unproductive, but now I got to fill the space instead of asking somebody else questions. And so I just thought I'd say a few words about, what's going on for the Greens nationally, which is that, you know, Cornel West is getting a lot of attention, and the main media narrative about him is he's a spoiler. He's spoiling the election. And I think we've got to argue that, no, Greens improve elections. We don't spoil them. So Cornell has an answer to the spoiler question. That's a ranked choice vote, national popular vote for president. And he should, every time the media calls him a spoiler, he should be saying, we got a solution to the spoiler problem. And will Biden join us in promoting it and working for it and turn the conversation around? Why isn't Biden supporting the solution to the spoiler problem? Because, you know, if Democrats are freaked out that they're going to, you know, the Greens are supposedly going to split off the left vote that the Democrats think they've got in their back pocket. So, but I think it's more than that, you know, not just that we have a solution to the spoiler problem, but that we improve elections when we run. We move the debate in a progressive direction where most of the Americans are. And then the Democrats have to respond. They have to talk to the issues we raise. And when they respond, they sound a lot better than the Republicans, who sound like right-wing extremists and callous people that don't care what happens to the people. So, you know, you can look at a lot of examples. I'll just mention a few. The Henry Wallace campaign in 1948. Truman was way behind Dewey. And then around Labor Day, he decided he's going to have to run on a progressive economic program. He basically stole Henry Wallace's domestic economic program, which was for what we today call single-payer health care. Back then it was national health insurance and a whole lot of other progressive economic programs that, you know, we still don't have today. But Truman ran on them, and over the course of after Labor Day in September and October, he was catching up on Dewey. And then, you know, there's the famous headline where it says Dewey won. That was out of one of the New York papers, but actually Truman won. And, you know, he won because Henry Wallace, you know, was putting out these progressive economic programs. And unless Truman adopted them, he was not going to be popular. So that's a case where the independent left improved the election and the result. I think another example is Ralph Nader in 2000. You know, Gore was running as, you know, the legacy or the continuation of the Clinton years. And people weren't having that. You know, that was corporate neoliberalism at its worst, you know, the NAFTA agreement and ending welfare as we know it, quote unquote, which really put a lot of people who need public assistance in a much more difficult situation. You could go on and on about the terrible things that Clinton did. And then Gore finally, with Nader kind of nudging him from the left, Nader actually gave Gore a whole program and said, you know, I'd like to talk to you about this. And, you know, if you implement it, it's going to help you. And Gore didn't have that meeting, but he did start to talk about some of those issues that Nader was raising. And he changed his theme. He now became, his slogan was for the people, not the powerful. And ran as much more of a populist. And Gore, Bush had been winning. Bush had kind of tried to co-opt the centrist and even liberal vote by calling himself a compassionate conservative. And Gore was getting no traction because he just sounded like, you know, he was kind of a wooden speaker anyway, and he had no real program. So then he adopted some of these things and ran on a populist theme for the people, not the powerful. And he started catching up, just like Truman had in 1948. And he actually won. You know, you go back and check the recount that the media did very meticulously. All the media organizations, the big ones, paid some people to do that. And it turns out Gore won Florida, therefore won the whole thing. But of course, the Supreme Court cut that short, the recount. And so Bush got in there, even though he didn't really win. So you could say that, you know, because Nader was in that race, Gore improved his campaign toward the end and actually won, or at least came very close to winning. And then I'll just give you one more example. I live in a congressional district in Syracuse, New York, the Metro District. In the 50 years since it became a single Syracuse Metro District, the Democrats have only won twice. And the only times they won is when a Green ran. And the Greens were vilified, oh, you're splitting the vote. But actually, we changed the debate because we were bringing up things like single-payer health care and a Green New Deal and taxing the rich. And the Democrat who had, you know, he was a third-way Democrat, kind of centrist, corporate. Without us in the race, he would run to the right and try to get the votes in the center. And what he did was lose his own base, who didn't become, they were not enthusiastic for him, and the Republican would win, you know, traditionally in that district by, you know, 5 to 10%. It was a pretty competitive district as districts go. But when the Greens were in the race, suddenly the Democrat had to respond to what we were saying. His response was not as callous and extremist as the Republican. So in those elections, one, I was the candidate, I got 4%, and the Democrat won by about 10% over the Republican. And then 4 years later, a young woman named Ursula Rosen, I was her campaign manager, she ran. She got 8%, and she was vilified. I mean, National Organization for Women, one of their founders, one of their first presidents, Karen Crow, you know, invited our candidate to dinner, and she thought, oh, great, I'm going to get some support. And they spent the whole dinner, you know, telling her she was splitting the vote and she should stop, and, you know, she was hurting women. And it was, you know, it was tough for her to stand up, but she did. She ran a great campaign. She got 8%. And the Democrat crushed the Republican because of the issues she was raising, these same issues. The Republican response was made him sound like an extremist and the Democrat more like a, you know, reasonable person. And then after, and this was the second time this Democrat won, the Greens didn't run the next time and he lost. So, you know, I just know too many examples where the Greens improve elections. And, you know, the dynamic going on now is Biden is moving to the right. He's playing the same old card playbook that the Democrats have used to lose elections. And they think if they run to the center or to the right, they can take their left for granted. And what they do is they lose the left. The left, you know, either votes for a Green or sits home. They lose enthusiasm. You know, why come out for the Democrats when they're not offering me anything? That's the way a lot of people look at it. And so what we got now is Biden moving toward the right, Trump moving toward jail, and the race is still a toss-up. In fact, Trump is much better positioned now than he was in 2020, where he had about a little under 40% of, you know, maybe 39% of the of support at this stage in the election, and now he's up near 50%. It's neck and neck. And, you know, what is Biden doing? He's really running hard to the right. I mean, the immigration stuff, you just, you know, the media has been reporting, you know, what's going on at the border. It is a humanitarian crisis. And Trump, I mean, Biden's policies are the same as Trump's. It's just not wrapped in the same scapegoating racist rhetoric. But the policies are the same. And the deportations, you know, like the Haiti, you know, 35,000 people deported to Haiti into that mess there. Very dangerous. And you can go to other things. So, note on my screen here. Okay. So that's one thing. Then you look back at the debt ceiling deal. I mean, Biden, you know, touts that as bipartisan agreement with the party that tried to overthrow his election, which doesn't make sense to me. And what he did was he accepted the Republican squeeze on non-military spending, which means after 50 years of growing economic inequality, there's going to be no support for people for things like housing, healthcare, education, and economic development in underprivileged communities. So that was the compromise, a move to the right. And then on climate, you know, while, you know, they tout what they're doing for renewable energy, they're actually permitting more fossil fuel projects. and at a faster rate than happened under Trump. And, you know, they tout that to that industry to get their support and those constituencies that like it. So, you know, the action is not being done on climate. And then another huge issue, which is not going to be debated in this election unless Cornel West can force a debate, is to push back on the, you know, bloated military spending that this country is engaged in and its prioritization of military over diplomatic solutions to conflict. And, you know, that is something that won't be debated, or the fact that we're modernizing our nuclear force, triggering a new nuclear arms race. And, you know, are we going to be demanding that the U.S. really get focused on nuclear disarmament negotiations with Russia and China and the rest of the nuclear powers? These kind of things won't be raised unless the Green Party raises them. So, you know, my argument is that we improve elections, we don't spoil them. And it's not just about who wins, although, you know, what I point out is when we're in, we actually help the Democrats more than we do the Republicans. Another thing is down ballot. You know, Greens don't have candidates in a lot of races. So, for example, in 2000, when Nader ran, Greens didn't have candidates for the U.S. Senate races in Michigan and Washington, which were very close. And a lot of people voted for the Democrat who wouldn't have come out to vote at all if Nader wasn't on the ballot. So his race is often given credit for the election of Debbie Stabenow in Michigan and Maria Cantwell in Washington. And that made the U.S. Senate a Democratic majority that year. So, you know, Ralph Nader did things there that, you know, Gore probably couldn't have. And at least as Ralph tells it, you know, Gore at this point isn't pissed at Ralph. He, you know, he's more worried about what the Supreme Court did. So I'm going to stop there and let's, you know, take your questions and comments and have a conversation. So what do we got? At war with us, U.S. oil production is forecast to average an all-time high of 12.8 million barrels per day, 13.1 million in 2024. The high mark of the Trump administration was 2.75 million barrels per day. It's nuts. Yeah, and I'm not saying that Trump is a lesser evil, but, you know, Biden isn't getting us to where we want to go. And I think there are larger forces at work in those numbers than the policy of Trump or Gore. You know, it's the world market, the fact that we've got this fracking industry up and running. So we're able to produce more oil than we could before, but, and then, you know, it's the market with the sanctions against Russia, at least the Western European, and, that market's opened up for U.S. producers. So, but yeah, it's not going in the direction of climate safety for sure. Zimani. Hi, someone should challenge Bernie and company to introduce a ranked choice voting bill into Congress. See how concerned they actually are about spoilers. You know, there is a bill in the House, and Bernie needs to be challenged to put it into the Senate. It's called the Fair Representation Act. I'm not going to guess at its number. I think I know what it is, but I don't want to give you the wrong number. But you can look it up. Fair Representation Act. It's sponsored by a moderate Democrat from Virginia. It has 9 co-sponsors, 7 of them members of the Progressive Caucus. 2 of them are members of the, what's it called? The Centrist Caucus. I forget the name, but it's a centrist caucus. And I think 1 or 2 of them are in both caucuses. But it's been around, you know, a few cycles of the Congress, a few sessions of Congress, but where are the progressives? They need to be challenged. I wrote an article for Ralph Nader's Capitol Hill Citizen. And what I did there is I took off from a remark by Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, where she said during the 2020 primaries, before Biden had, you know, won and Sanders was eliminated, she said, in any other country, Biden and I would be in different parties, you know, in other countries with proportional representation. And so I, just to do this article, I wrote to her office or emailed in Ilhan Omar's office, because she is from an area in St. Paul, Minnesota, with ranked choice voting, including proportional ranked choice voting for some boards in the city of Minneapolis, and to Jamie Raskin, who is, he's a co-sponsor of this bill I just talked about. He also wants to get rid of the Electoral College and go to a national popular vote. So, you know, I asked in the article, what about a ranked choice national popular vote? There's a bill for a national popular vote as well. But it, again, it doesn't have a lot of support. So I wrote that in that Capitol Hill Citizen, which is Ralph Nader's paper, that you got to pay $5 to get a hard copy. He doesn't put it online, although he puts his own articles on his own webpage, and I put the articles I've had in there on my webpage. So you can look up this article I'm talking about on HollyHawkins.us, where I challenge, you know, AOC and Ilhan Omar and Jamie Raskin. Only Raskin's staff got back to me and said Raskin would himself, but he didn't. That was in the period after his son committed suicide and he was getting cancer, so I don't really hold that against him. I'm glad that his staff got back to me. But the article said something like MIA, you know, missing in action, the progressives on ranked choice voting and proportional representation. So, Z Manny, someone did. I did. And I know others have, and I think more of us need to, particularly Bernie in the Senate. He should have a companion piece to the Fair Representation Act that's already in the House. And then all of us in our districts should be demanding that our representatives in Congress support that bill. And if they don't, run against them as Greens and say, you know, you're for having a inclusive multi-party democracy and your opponent is not, because they won't go for this Fair Representation Act for Congress. So, you know, get the authoritarian out and the Democrat small d in. So that's an issue that I think should be one of our top priorities. If we can get proportional representation in Congress, as well as state legislatures and city councils, the whole game changes. You know, the Greens will then get their fair proportional share of representation. We will be in the debate, not just when we try to run in these elections that are winner take all, single member district, win by plurality. We will be in the conversation because we're in the legislature, which gives us a certain, you know, cachet with the media and so forth. So that is, I think, the reform that will open up the door for the Greens and independent progressive politics in this country more than anything else. And I see Z Manny says, yeah, 3863. That sounds right. I think it's a good bill. One of the things some of us in this movement are talking about is increasing the size of the Congress, because we have such a high representative to voter ratio. You know, it's over 700,000 per constituent. And our, you know, there are national legislatures with many more representatives than we have. So if we increase the size of the Congress, and a lot of state legislatures and particularly city councils could do the same, we would get more representation per constituent and also more seats. So one of the things that the H.R. 3863, the Fair Representation Act, it calls for districts of between 3 and 5 to represent states. So in a big state like New York, you know, the districts would be 3 to 5 representatives. Which means if it's a five-seat district, it's like a little under 20% of the vote gets you a seat. If it's a three district, I think it's around 33% of the district. In any case, the point is that larger the number of seats in a district, the lower the threshold. Where they have party-list proportional representation in Europe, it's often 5%. It's 5% in Germany. It's 5% in Ukraine. We're looking at, when we talk about proportional ranked choice voting, a little different system. It's not where the party has a list of candidates and you vote for the party, and then, you know, the top of that list, depending on the your proportion of the vote, gets put in the legislative body. This would be voting for individuals. You can vote for individual in one party and individuals in another party. You just rank your choices. That's the way we're going to probably do proportional representation. That's what this bill proposes. All I'm saying is, if we have more representatives in Congress, then we could have bigger districts than 3 to 5, which would mean a lower threshold to get in. But, even with the thresholds that would be with 3 to 5, the Greens could get a lot of people into Congress right off the start. And then the smaller states, because they don't have many districts, they have to use ranked choice voting, even if it's not proportional, because they don't have enough districts. So, yeah, that's a great bill, 3863, and we should be behind it. Z Manny, I was watching David Cobb running an interview discussing the proportional representation initiative in California. It's part of a nationwide push, including Greens, Libertarians, Peace and Freedom. I'm not sure that I know that the Greens are involved in a push to get a mixed member proportional system like Germany has, like New Zealand has, which I think is a bigger lift than getting a proportional ranked choice voting. And then when you say that there's a nationwide push, the only nationwide push I know is coming from some very wealthy people involved in groups like Center for Political Innovation, Unite America. There's another one, but they're pushing, they're linking ranked choice voting to top 5 or top 4 primaries, which are not party primaries. They are open primaries. They're really not open. They're non-party primaries. I mean, traditionally, open primaries have been parties open up their primary to voters from other parties to vote in their primary. This is really a nonpartisan primary to get the top 5 candidates, which is destroying parties. I mean, we've seen in California where it's top 2. The Greens will meet and they will designate their candidate. And then other Greens who weren't designated or just, are acting on their own or aren't even Greens, will file as Green candidates, pay a filing fee, get on the ballot. So then when the rank and file Greens go to vote and they're looking for who the party recommends, they can't tell because these nonpartisan primaries, even though they got party labels, the parties have no control over who gets on the ballot. And that, what's the point of having a party to, again, nominate your own candidates and hold them to your own platform? So that's a big problem, and it's one of these days I'm going to write a op-ed called Ranked Choice Voting Yes, Top 5 No, because they don't need to be linked, and linking it to this open or nonpartisan primary basically allows the big money to come in and select who those they go on to the 5 or top 4 who then have a ranked choice vote, but it may have eliminated already, parties like the Greens. So I don't know more about, what initiative. The interviewee was Caledon Myers, California Proportional Representation Coalition. Yeah, I think that's the one that's pushing for mixed member proportional, which I don't know is linked to a national campaign, but maybe they know something or you know something I don't. Tomboy Wilson, how about one day national primaries for each party, independently administered and totally transparent? So you're talking about a presidential primary in every state on one day. Independently administered, you mean by the party themselves, and totally transparent. The United States is kind of unique in that we have the state-run primaries for parties. Some countries have primaries, but the parties run their own primaries and the members, insist that they be transparent. One of the problems in America is we don't have membership parties. We have memberless parties. So you tell the state which party you're registered in, and then you get that ballot. You get to vote on primary day, but otherwise you have no rights within that party to be heard and represented, and, you know, any power to vote on what the party should stand for or who the candidate should be, except in a primary. So, you know, the Greens are that way, as well as the Democrats and Republicans. There was a big debate in the Greens in the 90s, and unfortunately they went the memberless route, which is creates a problem for democracy, in my opinion. So one day, that would have to be a federal law, and a lot of the way the Constitution sets up elections is the states administer them. So I guess, but the Constitution does give Congress a lot of power to regulate those primaries. So I guess it would be constitutionally permissible. But I'm not sure, you know, what advantage that would have. One day, then your presidential candidates would have to be, they couldn't build momentum as the campaign goes on and attract support like Bernie Sanders did. If it was one day, one shot, you'd have to have a national campaign and enough money to run it. So I'm not sure that's a good idea. But on the other hand, I actually believe the parties, and this is what we did before we went to the primary system in the early part of the 20th century, is parties would have conventions, and they would decide among the members or delegates from locals to state conventions and so forth, who they wanted to nominate. The primaries were set up nominally to, you know, get beyond the party bosses, which did exist, particularly in urban machine politics, both Democratic and Republican Party. But for the Socialist Party, it was, you know, they were able to continue having conventions, nominate their candidates. And then when the primaries came in, they would run their candidates in the primary with the support of the party organization, and almost always got their nominated by convention candidates onto the ballot in the primary. That's where I'd really like to see us go. But it's a long answer to a pretty short question, so let's move on. At War with Dust, do you worry that nationalizing fossil fuels might encourage the U.S. to extract even more fossil fuels in corporations who may wind down production out of fear of lawsuits and lack of demand? I'm not sure what lawsuits the corporations, I mean, look at what Chevron did to Stephen Donziger, who got a judgment against them for, you know, ruining the lives of indigenous people in Ecuador. So they have no problem going to court. They got more resources than the government does. So I don't see that as the problem. Now, nationalizing, in other words, making fossil fuels and the companies extracting them public property, accountable to the public, which is the elected government, that's no guarantee that they will make right decisions with respect to fossil fuels and the climate impact. But I see it as a precondition, because the investor-owned oil companies have no incentive, because for them, oil and gas is the way they make their money. And they have no incentive to transition away from that. I mean, what they're trying to do is trick people with stuff like carbon capture and sequestration schemes. So they're saying, well, we can keep burning it and we just put it in the ground. And those projects have not proven to work. And there are other byproducts besides carbon that, you know, are bad from burning these fuels, like the particulate matter and the other pollutants that affect, you know, our lungs, cause asthma and other lung disease. So actually, most of the oil in the world is nationalized, whether you're talking about, you know, Russia or Saudi Arabia or Venezuela. You know, it doesn't matter whether they're left or right, Norway. Question is, what is the government's policy? And that's where the politics comes in. But I would say nationalizing the fossil fuel industry is a prerequisite to getting, because what we want is to use, and David Schwartzman, the Green from Washington, D.C., who's in the D.C. State of the Green Party, an expert on the transition to renewable energy, he says oil is what we need as the fuel to building a self-reproducing renewable energy system, because we're going to need some fossil fuels for the transition until those renewables are built up to the point where they're self-reproducing. So what you want is a national oil company that is down with that program and is part of the planning for it. So it is phasing out the use of fossil fuels, using the revenue from those fossil fuels to invest in renewables, and until the renewables are self-reproducing. That's, I think, where we want to go. But, you know, public ownership of the fossil fuel industry is part of the, it's a prerequisite to doing that transition. Angel Torres. Hi, Angel. Good afternoon, Howie Hawkins. Are you still seeking the nomination that Dr. Cornel West is running? The top five instant runoff voting is being pushed here in Arizona. Not sure if it'll be on the ballot for 2024. I'm frankly relieved Cornel is running. I'm not running. My campaign team from 2020 was in no position to reactivate, you know, between new kids and new jobs. Most people were just too busy, and two of my key people passed away, Bruce Dixon and Kevin Z. So I would have had to start from scratch. It's like starting a business, and it's, you know, I was not looking forward. A lot of people were encouraging me. And then when Cornel West stepped up, I said, I was relieved. And, you know, I called him soon after that, and we've talked a couple times. And so I'm supporting him. We have some political differences, but he's sure a lot better than Biden. So that's where I'm at right now. Top five. I know that the all the money going into these referendums is in Arizona. And I think they're going to get on the ballot in 2024. Maybe you know something I don't know now, but they got the money. They haven't failed yet. And I'm talking about millions and millions of dollars coming from corporate interests that, you know, I think the top five is what they're really concerned about, because then, you know, they basically push parties out of the way and they can buy the candidates. And then instant runoff voting gives us the illusion of choice. But if you don't have parties with different points of view originally selecting candidates to go to the general election ballot, you know, we'll be shut out in a back doorway. That's what I fear. Frankie Lee. Howie, who else besides Cornel is running as Green Party candidates for president? I'm not that familiar. I do know there are a couple people that seem to be making serious moves, but at this point, they really haven't come to my attention, and I haven't been looking for them. I figure if they are able to organize a serious campaign, I will hear about them, but at this point, I haven't. So I really can't say. That's not to disrespect those who are sincerely trying and trying to put together a campaign. I just am not familiar with them. Z Manny, have we heard anything new about New York State legislators introducing a bill to bypass court decision and restore third-party ballot access in New York? I have nothing new to report. Well, maybe for some people. We met with one of the senators' staff in May, and they seemed very supportive. And you know, our people were supposed to get them draft legislation, which we almost had done. I think summer got in the way. It just hasn't come together yet. So when I get back here from Chicago to New York, that's going to be top of my list to get that moving again and get moving with the you know, that legislator. And hopefully he'll get it started. I know people, including my own state assembly rep, who, you know, I think will introduce his companion with the senator, companion legislation in the assembly. And if we get that done, then we got something we can campaign around. And if we could get it passed when the legislature comes back in January, we could preempt this crazy petition we got to do and, you know, have a more reasonable petition for 2024 and get, you know, the Green Party candidate on the ballot. New York is so hard now that, you know, if Cornel West can raise a lot of money and do petitioning in most of the states, New York may be the only state he's not on the ballot, which would be, you know, a travesty. It's a big state, and you know, ironic given that, you know, these Democrats who aren't so progressive, like saying New York is the most progressive state in the nation, which is totally untrue, but you know how people promote themselves. So, but that's where it's at. And we'll be working on that, you know, in the fall. It's going to be a major focus for me. Lonboy Wilson, since the Supreme Court ruled parties are private clubs, let's end all matching funds. No more banquet tour buses and jets on the public dime. Well, the parties in America are hybrids. They're more regulated than they are in most countries. And the state, you know, does intervene a lot. Now, they should be private associations. They should make their own decisions on their own. But I don't see, you know, that in contradiction to having public funding of public elections. You know, the best system would be the clean money system, where every party's ballot qualified candidates get an equal public grant to run their election. It should be sufficient to communicate with the constituents. They should also be required to go into participate in publicly administered debates if they're going to take the public funding. But banquet tours and jets on the public dime, boy, nobody's doing that. I mean, at this point, the public money in the federal elections, major party candidates aren't taking the primary matching funds. The Green Party is the last one left trying to do that. And then there's another pot of money. If you get over 5% of the vote in the presidential election, you get a prorated share of the pot of money that goes to the major parties. So any party with over 25% of the vote is considered a major party. So that's Democrats and Republicans. And they get equal grants on Labor Day to run to the fall election, presidential election. And both parties use this money until Obama said, no, I can raise more money in the private sector. After promising to use this money when he was running against McCain, he didn't. McCain had to take that money because he didn't have that much money. Now, when I ran in 2020, that pot of money was about $100 million, a little over $100 million, to run the fall campaign, 2 months. Democrats and Republicans didn't want that because they were raising from private sources billions. So, you know, really the Greens are the only ones that still want that public money. And, of course, we'd use it for, you know, ground game, door knocking, you know, some TV advertising, you know, jets. I mean, what's wrong with getting to a city to talk to people? You know, even when I ran in my little campaign in 2020, I had to get on not private jets. I went on, you know, public carriers. But I, you know, I flew around. I didn't drive everywhere, although I did do a lot of driving. So I don't have a problem with that. And it's better that the public funded and, you know, regulated than have what we got now, which is not all the money. In fact, most of the money now is not even publicly reported. When they passed Citizens United, you know, those dummy justices said, well, you know, people can see where the money's coming from. No, they can't. A lot of it's dark money through those 501c4s that don't have to report their donors. And they turn around and put that money into things like super PACs. So we don't know where that money's coming from. It could come from anywhere, even foreign sources. So we have little transparency. Whereas if it was public money, you knew where it came from. They had to account for how it was spent. So I'm for publicly financed campaigns. And equal grants to everybody. What we got now is these matching funds. It's starting here in New York. And, you know, that actually magnifies the differences between candidates. So if you're, say, you get $50,000 in matching funds and the match is 6-1, and you're up against an incumbent who raised $500,000, 10 times more. So when you get the match for the $50,000, plus six, that's $650,000. And your opponent got $500,000. That would be, let's see, times six, $3.5 million. I did it right. So it's, you go from $50,000 to $500,000 to $350,000 and $3.5 million you know, the gap between the two in terms of total financing increased. So the matching fund system is something the incumbent parties dreamed up to, you know, sort of have their small donors matched and magnify the difference between them and the little startups like the Green Party, that if they can reach the thresholds, they're not going to have as much money as the major parties. Even the money that will be matched, and the differences after matching will be greater than they were before matching. So that's why we need a full public campaign financing system instead of the partial funding system of matching funds. So I don't know if that came across clearly. It kind of gets esoteric when you do these numbers, but I've written about that, and I think, you know, you might need to look that up to really get it, you know, why the matching funds magnifies the differences between low and high funded candidates. Lonboy Wilson, we should keep all domestic fossil fuels off the world market and enter a covenant with Venezuela for our heavy crude, no more shipping fuel around the world. I'm not sure what to think of that. I mean, that sounds to me like kind of protectionist, and as if we stop shipping the fuel, people will stop using it. They'll just get it from other sources. So I'm not sure what the purpose of that is. And a covenant with Venezuela for our heavy crude. It's Venezuela that's got the heavy crude and needs refinery. So I'm not sure, you know, where that gets us. What we got to do is have a transition away from oil, including Venezuela, which, you know, is reliant and counting on that oil to finance their development. And, you know, I remember hearing about, you know, Dennis Brutus, the great anti-apartheid activist from South Africa, Patrick Bond, who's a radical political economist still in South Africa. Dennis has passed on. And they had a meeting with Hugo Chavez. And Dennis, who, you know, got in trouble with the apartheid regime, he told Chavez, you know, you gotta leave that oil on the ground. We gotta find other ways to develop, and, you know, around renewable energy, and, you know, because the planet can't stand the burning of this fossil fuel. So I think that's where we really gotta go. And that, you know, we can nationalize, as we talked about earlier, our oil companies, but we gotta figure out a way to coordinate this across the globe. And that's where we run into trouble with, you know, the supposedly rival, you know, great powers like China, Russia, and Saudi Arabia and the U.S. When they get to the COP summits, the conferences of the parties, the global climate summits, they, you know, agree with each other to block, you know, real commitments to reducing fossil fuel consumption by certain timelines. And most of the global South and the more progressive countries of the world are pushing for that. It's these big powers, these big petrol states, either big consumers like China or big producers like Russia, Saudi Arabia, and the U.S., you know, push against that. So, you know, all I can say is that that's why we need an international left that transcends these boundaries and doesn't let, you know, capitalism, if you know, you get a progressive government in one country, they just move to another reactionary country and reopen there. So We got a huge problem, because we really need a left that can, you know, we got a rising global right and climate crisis. And the more the climate crisis generates refugees, and then they get scapegoated by the right, and that mobilizes more right-wing politics in those countries. We're in a bad dynamic, and we got to break it up. That's why the left, I mean, we can't settle for people like Biden. We really need to put forward a left alternative and organize around that and build it. And that's what we need to do in this country, and we need to align with people doing it in other countries. Zimani, how much of the money raised for a campaign is used for media exposure? In general, I mean, like with these multi-million dollar duopoly campaigns. Well, from what I've seen and know, most of the money is used for media. To an extent that, I mean, one of the criticisms I have of the Bernie Sanders campaign is 2016. Tad Levine was his big advisor. And Tad Levine, let me just say as a preface, was somebody who was working for Paul Manafort and supporting the, you know, Ukrainian oligarchs elections, Yanukovych and those people, before he came back and took a job with the Bernie Sanders campaign. And Bernie, I guess, hired him because he had long experience in Democratic Party politics and also politics overseas. In fact, if you read about this guy, he said, that guy in Louisiana, the Clinton guy. Forgetting his name. He's kind of a foul-mouthed Louisiana guy. I'm blanking on his name. But he said, you know, why work for $50,000 for a U.S. campaign when you can work for one of these corrupt governments overseas? They're candidates for a few million dollars in a campaign. So anyway, Tad Levine, his advice to Sanders leading up to the California primary was to blow all the money he'd raised on media rather than a, you know, on the ground canvassing, door knocking campaign. And when I saw that, I said, yeah, if Bernie's doing that, they're all doing that. So yeah, media is where they, and the other thing about it, media is like, once you've done enough to get your name out there and your picture and people know who you are, the messaging there is, it's all emotional, you know, what you say. I've been on TV, I get interviewed, you know, as I'm running a campaign and people say, hey, I saw you on TV. I say, well, what'd you think about what I said? And most people say, I don't remember what you said, but you look good on TV. So, you know, that's what that's about. And, you know, you should spend enough to, you know, so people know you're a serious candidate and, you know, give them a good vibe in what you present. But you got to do more than that to persuade people. And that's where the door knocking is the most effective form of persuasion to move people to your position in an election. So I think, yeah, there's a lot of money wasted on media. You know, the media loves it because they make a lot of money during elections, but it's probably not the best for our civic education and, you know, smart voting. See, Manny, it seems now we have an informal indie media coalition backing up West Green campaign and pushing back against mainstream media. They're also pushing green recruitment and ballot access. Maybe push New York State. Yeah, I'm not sure who all you're referring to. Maybe some podcasters. Haven't seen any other independent media giving Cornell a lot of support. He did get on Democracy Now, I believe. But, you know, I hope you're right. Maybe it's stuff I haven't seen. But that's... That would be different than 2020 when all the so-called independent media was all for Biden to stop Trump. Maybe they've realized that didn't stop, you know, right-wing conservative politics from the federal government, which was my argument in 2020. You know, it's like, if you want to beat Trump, present a positive progressive program and, you know, force the Democrats to come with that. Amy L. Sachs, at Star War with Dust, Jason Call, a Washington candidate, covered agitators confronting the well-to-do in Martha's Vineyard over their corporate-loving energy policy. Needs to be hammered on by more Green Party candidates. Okay, Jason Call, a Washington state candidate, covered agitators confronting well-to-do in Martha's Vineyard, which is in Massachusetts. So I guess you're saying independent media. He did it on a podcast or with an independent media program. I'm not sure what that is, but the idea that the a lot of the climate action people have been out to places like Martha's Vineyard and the Hamptons on Long Island and done protests against the corporate executives of these energy giants. And that's fine. I think the exposure is good, although I think the focus should be on not trying to shame corporate executives who are shameless, but, you know, getting policies changed, getting new candidates in office, getting the policies changed. That's what really will make a difference. Okay, he boosted them on Twitter, Knitter. I guess that's not official, but that's what you're calling Twitter, or X, formerly known as Twitter. Okay, well, yeah, we should be, you know, boosting stuff that we like and think is good and has the right message. Okay, Violet says Tim Black has devoted his whole channel to promoting Cornell. Yeah, that's great. Angela and I tried to get on him, and he just was not responsive in 2020. But, you know, we were just working class, you know, truck drivers and warehouse workers. Knitter being a mirror site, which you can read even without a Twitter account. Okay, that's something. You learn something all the time. I think that's right. These rich corporate-friendly organizations like Sierra Club will never endorse Greens because they live off the largesse of rich endorsers to keep them afloat. See also McKibben and the odious Josh Fox. The Sierra Club, I mean, God, their leader signed a letter of, you know, so-called prominent environmentalists that the Daily Beast wrote up about, and I got interviewed before I'd even seen the letter, and I thought it was people like McKibben and Fox that have more cachet, and what it was a bunch of, you know, old environmentalists from the 70s that not too many people knew, but the, you know, the Sierra Club guy that wanted, he signed, and I wrote a response to this, I guess it was in Counterpunch, he had taken a lot of money from the gas industry, which is the same as the oil and gas industry, to promote natural gas as the bridge fuel to the future. And this was in the late, 2000s and early 2010s. And it became a big scandal. He had to quit as head of the Sierra Club. And the Sierra Club, which is a membership organization, the rank and file pushed back. And they stopped saying natural gas is a bridge fuel. Sierra Club is a big green group that is focused on Washington and does, you know, tend to be cautious. So they support Democrats as a lesser evil. That's all true. But Sierra Club, you can actually make changes within, which I've seen the New York chapters of Sierra Club did on the question of fracking in New York. Originally, the Sierra Club was for fracking. Because it promoted natural gas as the bridge fuel. We were saying that there's no bridge there. You're going to go flying over the cliff if you go the natural gas route. So anyway, that's part of the problem with Big Green. The big donors do try to influence. McKibben, I'm not sure about his funding sources. He's got this elders group, Third Act, I think they call it. I don't know. I don't know anything about their funding. I don't know if he's getting corporate funding. You know, my beef with Bill McKibben is when I first started running for president in 2020, he went to the pages of the New Yorker to say, I shouldn't run for president. I should push for ranked choice voting. And then he proceeded to trash the American Greens and praise Greens elsewhere, where they do have proportional representation. And of course, my response was, hey, if I wasn't in the election to raise ranked choice voting, you sure weren't going to get it from Biden or even Sanders. So, you know, McKibben has defaulted to the Democrats, and I think that's a problem because that the climate movement gets taken for granted. And the odious Josh Fox. Yeah, Josh Fox told me to my face why the Greens should not be supported for the lesser evil arguments. You know, when we were fighting fracking back in the day in New York. So, I he's not high on my list. In any case, that's why we need, organizations that are membership funded and can be militant without afraid of biting the hand that feeds them. And that's a real problem now. We got the nonprofit industrial complex basically setting limits on what the movements can do. A. Jones, 35. How's the Green Party have any plans for a presidential debate? I was there in Boise, Idaho in 2019, the last time the Green Party had one. But we had more debates than that one in Idaho. We went into 2020, but yeah, I think everybody wants to have debates. State parties can set them up. The national probably set them up at the, well, that would have been this year, huh? Like 20, yeah. Well, the national party should, in my opinion, you know, have some nationally sponsored debates. So, and then any state party can, you know, host a debate for their primary or their convention and ask the candidates to participate. That's what we did in the 2020 cycle, and we had a lot of debates. Blonde Boy Wilson, a united Green Left plus independence equals victory. Yeah, if we could get the independents are spread politically from left to right, so I don't think we can assume they're with, you know, the Green Left. But a lot of them, you know, would like us better than they do the Democrats and Republicans. And to me, it comes back to we got to have a system where the spoiler problem doesn't come up. A lot of people are going to want to vote for Cornel West, but they're afraid of Donald Trump, so they're going to vote for Biden. And that's why this ranked choice voting and proportional representation issue, to me, is like it's the first priority. We get that passed, then the whole political system opens up to where the Greens get their fair share of representation, and we're in the debate all the time, and then we can really move our issues like Medicare for All and the Green New Deal. Okay, well, we're coming up on the hour. So next week we're going to have Natalie Monarez, who's a Amazon worker at the Staten Island Hub where they voted for a union. She's going to talk about the terrible working conditions, health and safety violations that people are going through, the problems they've had consolidating their union. There's a lawsuit against the leaders you've heard about, who seem to be AWOL a lot. So we're going to talk about all that. This is part of, you know, issues that you know, workers are dealing with. Bill Berry will also be there. He's a longtime union organizer. He's in the Maryland Green Party. So that's September 9th. And then, you know, the people I talk to here is, one is a Hong Konger, anti-imperialist. We talk about what happened in Hong Kong. And he's been writing about multipolarity is not necessarily progressive, if it's a multipolar imperialism and authoritarianism and what we need for an international left. Another woman, Bonnie Jin, is from Taiwan, and she will tell you that the Communist Party of China used to be for Taiwan independence, self-determination, until they took power in 1949. But the Taiwanese, you know, they got rid of the dictatorship that Chiang Kai-shek brought across the border. And, you know, they want to keep their democracy. So that's another issue. Another speaker, I hope you get, is Paul LeBlanc, who wrote a book, co-authored a book on the Freedom Budget for a New America. I forget the exact title, but it's a great book. I mean, it's the book I always give young activists if they ask me for a recommendation. So I ran into him here, and we can talk about that. And then the other guy was Danny Katch, who has a book called Socialism Seriously. And Danny is a humorist as well as a serious activist. And he'd written a book in the mid-20-teens. I wrote a, you know, book blurb for it, saying if everybody had read this book, we'd have socialism by now. But he decided to rewrite it because a lot has changed since then. And as it says, this is his humorous side on the cover of the new book, 50% more socialism. Like it's, you know, a box of cereal and you get 54% more cornflakes. But so that's four people that I'm going to have on here at some point as we go forward. And there's some others as well. We just got to lay down the dates. So that's what's coming up. And I appreciate everybody being here. And I got to run off to a workshop here pretty soon that I don't want to miss at this conference in Chicago. Some of the panels will be online. If you go to Socialism 2023, Google that. You can see those that are being live streamed. I expect there's one panel, I think it's tonight. Naomi Klein is going to talk about the role of conspiracy theory in confusing the left, which has become a problem where the right tends to encroach on the left with some crazy ideas, which is a phenomenon that's, alarmed a lot of people. And, Naomi is a very effective writer. I mean, she's the one that, brought the, what's the name of the book? The Shock Doctrine. I think that was the name. It's how capitalism takes advantage of crises to advance its interests. So anyway, that's one thing going on here. And but what I'm saying, there it is. You go on to the link that's in the chat. You can see what the sessions are, and some of them are online. So even if you can't be here physically, you can be here virtually and see what we're talking about. So anyway, thanks for coming. We'll see y'all next week, and have a good week.